The view from my desk looks across a ragged collection of dandelion, smutgrass, and domesticated shrubbery that makes its pathetic claim to be a slice of a natural ecosystem in the midst of a very urban environment. Small though it may be, this yard hosts a regular stream of animal visitors. Most are small mammals that claim a Norwegian ancestry to put some distance between themselves and the common rats that are their cousins. But a few are larger beasts that have tried to make their home amidst the human tenants. A blue heron, for example, a brace of ducks, and a rather extended family of raccoons. Beyond the far edge of this landscape stands a row of six small houses. When I first moved to the neighborhood, I concluded, without any evidence, that these buildings stood on the street that ran behind our house. Only after a year, or maybe two, did I discover that these little homes are alley dwellings and are entirely contained within the block. They were built over a century ago to house the workers that kept the neighborhood clean. Street sweepers, domestic maids, garbage pickers. Garbage picking was a common occupation at the turn of the 20th century. Whole families scavenged for a living, wrote the historian Susan Strasser. The biggest cities had neighborhoods full of streets with names like Bottle Alley or Rag Picker's Row. As in our neighborhood, the scavengers often lived in hidden enclaves amongst wealthier families. The two groups benefited from such a close proximity. One set of families produced trash, the other disposed of the refuge while claiming anything that they could find of value. Ignorance about trash was a luxury, Strasser wrote. Most people were fundamentally oblivious to what happened to household trash once it left their sight. The computer and digital communication technology have allowed us to put a fair amount of distance between ourselves and the dirtier parts of the modern economy. We no longer need to live near a garbage dump, a refuse transfer station, or even a recycling center. Yet digital technologies are part of the industrialized economy, and one of the sad legacies of that economy is the mass production of garbage. One measure of our modern wealth is the size of the garbage dumps that have arisen outside our cities, large and small. In many ways, computers have slowed the rise of those dumps by determining ways of using our resources more efficiently. At the same time, they've also increased the size of those dumps as old computers, replaced by newer and faster offspring, move off the prime desktop space and slouch towards the world's landfills. Like so many industries that have had their place in the sun, this computer industry has a way to go before it is truly a green activity, before it leaves the earth in better shape than it found it. For a time, I worked with an environmental engineer named Jake. He and I were regular speakers on the technology and society circuit, where we told the youth of today that engineering was not a cold, mechanical activity, but a noble vocation that expresses the ideals and aspirations of human beings. Unlike me, Jake was both a competent engineer and a good storyteller who could explain how he had been able to improve the environment. He would visit factories and look at their manufacturing process, product operations, waste disposal plans. He could quickly identify a weakness that ordinary mortals had missed, a leaking air hose, an extra quarter mile traveled by delivery trucks, a reusable solvent dumped into a drain. When told of the problems, the factory management, infinitely thankful for the discovery, would fix the error, and the world was cleaner as a result. Profits were increased, jobs were saved for future generations. These talks benefited from the fact that Jake looked and acted the role of romantic hero. He was witty. He was very good-looking. He rode a bicycle to work. In the end of his talk, he would have convinced everyone in the room that they were going to follow his path. He even got them to march around the room singing a recruiting song that followed the tune of a 1950s television song. "Engineer," it began, the chorus. "P PhD Money in private. Jake was far more sober. One evening when we were both relaxing over a glass of expensive designer water, he confessed to me that he had recently abandoned a book project. I was going to write about the re-engineering that we would need to make the economy truly sustainable, he said. But I quit in a fit of depression. No one would be willing to accept the sacrifices required by a truly sustainable economy. No one would even be willing to read about them. After staring at the bubbles in the water for a minute or so, he added, "There is simply no such thing as a green economy. There are only economies that are less brown. Carbonated water can do that to you. It can make a man morose at times." The computer industry has made some improvements in the three main areas that touch the natural environment: operations, manufacturing, and disposal. Of these three areas, the operational sector has perhaps made the most visible strides because it is the easiest one to analyze and to quantify. The biggest component of the operational impact is electricity, and electricity is measured in multiples of watts. The simplest way to reduce the impact is to reduce the number of watts the machine consumes. Stop the disk when it's not being used. Slow the processor when it's not doing useful work. Darken those displays that have nothing to show. With a fairly straightforward analysis, we can reduce the electrical usage of a single computer. We find the problem a bit more difficult when we look at successive generations of computers. New models might actually use more electricity than their predecessors, but they also might be more efficient because they can do more work. However, we find it hard to quantify the concept of computing efficiency. Green computing has no widely accepted metrics, so you must be careful to compare apples to apples when talking about architectural change, wrote the editors of a recent special issue of IT Professional. The architectural view has stymied us for 60 years as we have struggled with the simpler problem of measuring a computer's overall speed. Do we report instructions per second, operations per second, throughput based on a fixed set of programs? If we use a fixed set of programs, how do we select those programs? As we've been unable to answer those questions in all generality, we should not be surprised that we have not moved any closer to finding a universal measure of efficiency. Do we measure instructions per watt? Operations per watt? Watts required for a fixed benchmark? In spite of the fact that we have no solid answers to the problems of measuring energy efficiency, we have made at least some improvements to our large computers. The current generation of large scientific processors is about 300 times more efficient, as measured by performance per watt, than its predecessors of 15 years ago. If these machines were run at the same speed as those older scientific machines, we would see a substantial savings in electricity. However, the new processors run considerably faster than the devices they replaced. As a result, they actually consume roughly 30 times more electricity than those scientific computers of a generation ago. This increase is substantial. Today, reported a pair of experts, several of the most powerful supercomputers on the top 500 list require up to 10 megawatts of peak power, enough to sustain a city of 40,000. Of course, scientific supercomputers consume only a small amount of the electricity channeled to computing machinery. The world holds only a couple hundred supercomputers, but it supports more than a billion laptops. As we've done with the large machines, we have put those more common devices under the control of power management systems. Viewed on a computer-by-computer basis, we have seen substantial power conservation over the past 20 years. The second area where computing technology directly touches the environment is the factory, the place where chips are made and computers are assembled. This is the world where Jake made a living by reducing waste, removing inefficiencies, decreasing the use of toxic substances. The job of cleaning the factory floor is more complicated than the task of reducing electrical usage, but it is still fairly amenable to the tools of engineering. We can isolate that job within the walls of the fab or the assembly facility and focus our attention on a limited number of issues, something that we cannot do on the third environmental issue of the computing age, the disposal of unwanted equipment. Trash is not unique to the computer industry. It's merely one of the hallmarks of mass production and mass consumption. Most Americans produced little trash before the 20th century, wrote Strasser. The majority of households had ways of reusing much of what we now call garbage. Towns had scavenger pigs that would eat unconsumed food, and families of scavengers who would pick through garbage in search of usable food or materials. Nothing is inherently trash, noted Strasser. Trash is created by sorting, by separating what is desired from that which is not. The industrial age has altered that sorting procedure. It has labeled as trash many substances that once had value: rags, cooking grease, packing materials. The computer age has further changed that procedure, reducing the time it takes for something to be called refuse to the 18 months of Moore's Law, and adding to the garbage heap machines that are perfectly functional but can no longer run the most recent software, read the most recent files, or connect to the most recent network. At the moment, we produce 40 million tons of high-technology refuse a year. By some estimates, no more than 8 million of those tons are recycled. Traditionally, recycling is done at the edge of society. Garbage picking was done in the alley, out of sight of the houses on the main street. Composting piles are placed far away from a house, often in the back corner of a lot. The modern recycling of paper and metal occurs at the industrial fringe of cities. Computer recycling uses the technology of the globalized age. Modern transportation and high-speed communications make it possible to do such work in Africa and southern China, far from the computer stores, software labs, and shiny offices of the computer companies. West Africa is the smaller of the two recycling regions, but it still receives a massive amount of computer trash. One environmental organization reported that Lagos Port in Nigeria receives 500 containers of used computer equipment a month. It is a digital dump, reports another group, the place where computers go to die. The garbage pickers of our age sort through this material in search of working machines that might be reused. They dissect the machines to extract the valuable elements: chips, copper cable, gold plating. Unlike the careful and immaculate process that built these machines, the recycling process is ugly, dirty, hazardous. The recyclers break screens with hammers, burn boards with charcoal, and strip metal with solvents. Several activist groups trying to draw attention to the plight of workers at these recycling sites describe these facilities in the bleakest of terms. We've found excess heavy metals in the soil, as well as in the plants and people who eat vegetables, wrote one commentator. The bulk of computer garbage is merely dumped in a heap. Every 18 months, a new generation of machines joins the pile. They are smaller and faster and more efficient than their predecessors, but they are garbage nevertheless. These piles will be the lasting legacy of the information age, just as the garbage dumps outside of cities are the lasting legacy of industrialization. They will stand long after the plants in Silicon Valley and other technology centers have closed. They will be visible long after people have forgotten how to program in Java, configure a Unix system, or write columns about technology and society. Someday in the future, a distant generation will dig into these garbage heaps to understand our age. They will try to reconstruct our lives from smashed Game Boys, broken smartphones, crushed laptops. What did these things do, they will ask? How did they work? What were their owners like? I suppose that we should take as one of our grand challenges the task of making computing truly green, of putting into the earth no more than we took out. It's not going to be an easy task. Too much of what we do in the name of green computing merely moves the problem out of our sight and puts it in the hands of distant technicians with little incentive to dispose of the waste in a way that leaves the earth untouched by our technologies. My friend, Jake, lost all hope of ever finding such a solution, and he ultimately abandoned his work in despair. Let us hope for someone of stronger metal, who will pick through the refuge of environmental theories that we have created and find a strategy that will make computing truly green, or at least much, much less brown.